You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Hi, this is Peter Jackson, and welcome to Bums on Seats. I love saying that. I'm going to say it again. Bums on Seats. Yeah, so enjoy the show.
I bid you welcome.
Boy, all we got to do is build an act. Make you star. Dumbo the Great.
Zero G and I feel fine.
Well, you slime-eating dogs, you scum-sucking pig, you sons of a motherless goat.
I am big. It's the picture that got small.
I've never been alone with a man before, even with my dress on. With my dress off, it's most unusual.
What is it?
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hey, what about Major Kong?
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Many thanks to Ian Dayborn, nestled nicely into his new slot from 10 p.m. But now at just past 12 p.m, it's time for Bums on Seats, a happy hour at the Film Critics Bar. Everybody is welcome, though any talk about Oscar buzz will get you thrown out. My name is Toby Miller, and with me for the first show proper of 2016 are Emma Marchant.
Good morning.
Yossi Osman.
Hello.
Ashley Capaldi.
Ciao, ciao.
And Simon West.
Hello.
Our first proper show of the year is an all-review affair, taking in a clutch of new film releases that move from the widest of panoramas to the smallest of sets. Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight is an Wardian drawing room mystery transposed to the bloodthirsty beginnings of America. The Danish Girl is a far gentler affair, though it details the ferocious storm of human identity. Jennifer Lawrence stars in Joy, the tale of an American housewife with a little idea that led to great things. Room keeps its unsettling drama within four tight walls, whilst The Revenge of the Revenant plays out on the vast canvas of wilderness America. So, lots to come, but we'll get the ball rolling by holding up with some undesirables.
Okay, everybody, hear this. I'm taking this woman to hang. Rewards $10,000. That money's mine, boys.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Hold on!
You think I'll make a hoose with that fella or her?
That's my problem, boy. I don't know.
One of them fellas will kill everybody in here.
Now we're talking!
Let's slow it down. Let's slow it way down.
You know I'm coming.
When you get to hell, tell them Daisy sent you.
No one said this job's supposed to be easy.
Nobody said it's supposed to be that hard, neither.
Our first port of call for 2016 is Minnie's Haberdashery, a log cabin pit stop on the Wyoming Trail to Red Rock in the claustrophobic setting for The Hateful Eight, the ninth feature film from director Quentin Tarantino. Filmed in the very rarely used super-wide ultra Panavision format, so that's a projected image that's 2.76% wider than it is tall, whilst most films you would just see, Lord of the Rings, that's 2.35% wider. So it's very rare to see a film this wide. The Hateful Eight begins on a snowy mountain trail. Here, ex-major Marquis Warren, played by Samuel L. Jackson, talks his way onto the stagecoach of Kurt Russell's bounty hunter, John Ruth. Ruth is taking Jennifer Jason Leigh's handcuffed villain to be hanged, but all find their journey curtailed when the weather worsens and they're forced to hole up in a mountainside cabin that's just busy with sheltering, trigger-happy strangers. Ashley, to begin with you, many critics still, after all of these years, harp on about Tarantino's magpie style, like nobody else lives from other films. He does take a little bit from this, a little bit from that, but he does tend to make something fairly new with the parts. Is this the case with The Hateful Eight? Because it's part John Carpenter's thing, part Edwardian Agatha Christie mystery, and, you know, 70% Western.
So long as you're not looking for a spaghetti western, you'll be fine. This is very much his version of it. Rumour has it he's retiring after the 10th film, so he's ticking this genre off his personal CV, and it is very much Tarantino's version of a Western, so no vast desert expanses or heroes in this, I don't think. So as long as you're not looking for one particular genre, you should still enjoy the ragtag bundle of what he's given you.
Did you enjoy the ragtag bundle?
After the strange interval that the cinema I saw it at decided to give us, yep, it picked right up for the final half. The first half, I'm not sure I can forgive him for. Up until now, Tarantino's sort of Teflon-coated for me, could do no wrong, but there's just no excuse to leave an audience hanging for an hour and a half.
How? Because is it? I've not seen, because you saw it at the View Cinema. Yeah. They seem to have stuck an intermission in it, despite it not being the 70mm print that should have an intermission. So I'm not sure whether the intermission that they've added is in the right place or not, having not seen it at View. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't seem to be doing anything too much out of the ordinary. It's a film of... Inglourious, for instance, is, what, 7 parts? Most of them extremely long. This seems to be part of... Does he go too far with that technique?
The burn was too slow. Considering what he achieved in the final 45 minutes, if you can do that, do it throughout, or at least for a little longer. It was a slow, slow birth, but the payoff was worth it.
Emma, you're...
I disagree. I saw it in Bishop's Stortford, actually, and they didn't put the intermission in, so it was just a flat 3-hour running time. But they do, he does have the cards up telling you the chapter, so you know where you are. I think what you didn't say, Toby, is the other thing. It really is about 30% Jacobean tragedy, I felt. It was like a John Webster play, because everyone's just soaked in blood by the end of it.
It's Monty Python salad days, isn't it?
So much blood.
But no, I felt that the slow burn, as Ashley called it, it worked brilliantly for me. I sat there, and you know what? I couldn't believe it's been 23 years since Reservoir Dogs came out, and it just made me think, my word, you know, we were so, you know, Tarantino was such an exciting, it was such an exciting thing at that point when he came out with Reservoir Dogs, and there is quite a lot of Reservoir Dogs in this, because it is, you know, it's that claustrophobic kind of, they're all baddies, and weirdly enough, even though he's used this massively wide form of film, of course, it's almost entirely set in a cabin, which is an interesting choice.
It's the same as The Master did. Master used its 70mm to increase the claustrophobic sense that you can get with that ultra wide.
And it does work. And I think as well, you know, you've got to give props to the actors here, who are a combination of course, Tarantino regulars. Kurt Russell is excellent. Tim Roth is a joy. And then there's a couple of new ones. Obviously, Jennifer Jason Leigh, I don't believe, has been in a Tarantino film before. Yes. It's nice to see her back. She has.
Jackie Brown.
Do you remember that one? Sorry.
Is she Jackie Brown? Are you mistaking her for Bridget Fonda?
That's a good point, because they were in single white females together.
Let's anyway. Drop everything else and see where the sign is getting.
And Walton Coggins, who I believe is best known for Justified on the TV, was a revelation as Sheriff Chris Mannix.
Brilliant.
It luxuriates in its long running time, but it didn't feel long to me. If you know Quentin Tarantino, you'll know what to expect. It is a Tarantino film through and through, and I enjoyed it.
Simon, you were impressed, but less impressed than you had been by these last couple.
I think it's probably his weakest film, besides Jackie Brown, which we mentioned earlier. But having said that, Tarantino at his weakest is still better than 99% of the other stuff that's out there. It is still an amazing film. I actually thought the second half was weaker rather than the slow burn of the first half.
Nope.
And if they cut half an hour of the film, which they could easily have done, it should have come from the second half. I mean, the dialogue just drips as much as the blood does. The only other problem we've got is Tarantino does pinch a lot from a lot of other films, but I found in this one he did seem to be pinching a lot from his own previous films, which I hadn't seen on them before, and it did make me wonder whether he's starting to run out of ideas.
Photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy.
I'd like to think of it more as a deliberate homage rather than running out of ideas. Personally, I'd like to think of it kind of following on from Django, but bringing in some of the earlier. That's been maybe very charitable.
Back to you, Simon, but you'll see it's let's talk Tarantino and violence for a little bit, because Django, his last film, is sort of actually pulls back on the violence. It has a lot of violence in it, but he depicts it differently because he's disgusted by the violence in it, and he has honourable characters in that film. This is that all of The Hateful Eight are indeed hateful, and that allows him a gleeful, as you say, Jacobean, Emma said, a Jacobean sense of bloodletting. Does it become too gleeful? Is it too much? Because there are still things like violence to women and use of derogatory terms that get wrapped up in this, and audiences don't know how to respond. Is he playing this game intelligently, or is he just getting confused.
That's a difficult one. Sorry, I'm still reeling in horror from Simon saying that Jackie Brown is one of his worst films, but I'll leave that.
He doesn't know who's in it. Pay no attention to him.
Yeah, I was wrong. You are right. It was Bridget Fonda, but I don't really watch
anyway.
Carry on. Let's concentrate.
Sorry, in terms of the violence, this is the tricky aspect of Tarantino, because you go into his films expecting to see violence. But in this one, I did feel like it was a lot more humorous in places, a little bit more lighthearted, a couple of particular scenes. But I think because all the characters are just so vile and so horrible to each other, it makes it perhaps a little bit more excusable.
To a large extent, I think that works, and he's obviously not the first director to do this, but we do have a female character. Yes, she's a villain, she's a dreadful human being, but he's been very good with female characters in the past, but she's beaten up an awful lot, and it is played for laughs because that's the tone of the film.
I think there we have to look at her as a character herself, though, because what I find with her is she's quite vile, but she expects the violence and she gives her own with her words, with how she acts.
But does Tarantino get that across? Because you can make that distinction.
Yeah.
But there's a danger here that he's playing to the gallery so much with a certain amount of the violence that there'll be members of the audience who don't see that he's aiming for that distinction. I'll come to you in a moment, Emma, as you're shaking your head.
I'm not sure. I totally got it when I watched it. At first, I have to admit, the first, I think she gets punched within like the first 5 minutes of the film or something. And I was a bit like, oh, we're heading in this direction. But actually, I think because she plays so well, her character is so strong and her, she gives her all, basically, I think it's not too bad, and I could make that distinction, and I didn't feel like anyone else in the screening was that shocked or horrified by it, because she's on equal footing with all the other seven main characters in terms of how she is, how they're all vile, they're all horrible, they're all going to punch and beat each other up. That's just how it is.
Emma, microphone?
I would agree, because I'd also say, of course, Kill Bill, there's massive amounts of violence against women in Kill Bill. There's an awful lot, so it's not exactly new for him. And that was accepted. But also, I think what's really good about it is that first punch comes from Kurt Russell to Jennifer Jason Leigh's character. Because there is a danger that Kurt Russell is going to be the one you feel sympathetic to. Because come on, it's Kurt Russell. Everyone likes Kurt Russell. He's got a big moustache. He's almost the cuddliest character in it. When he does that in the first 5 minutes, you're like, whoa. Oh no, I see where we're going here. So I think that's why it's quite, like Yossi was saying, it's quite cleverly done. They are hateful, they're all despicable. And you know, she might not do it on screen, but you know that Daisy Domahue has done some vile and low down things.
I actually think that was what was quite brave about it, that he did have that violence against her, because actually I felt like it put her more on an equal playing field with all the other male characters in the film. And I actually think that was quite well done.
And obviously he's not the best writer of female characters that's ever made films, but he's always been as fair as his talents allow, and much fairer than many. And we seem to forget that with every new film, because obviously Django had a sort of fairly subservient female character, who was mainly just an object, but that was rare for him then. Now let's move over to Tarantino and anger. His last two films, Django and Inglourious, they're fascinating because they're furious. They're really furious films, and he's using, whether it's about the persecution of the Jews or slavery, he's making very serious points. But because how, by channeling exploitation, by making these films exploitation films, so the violence can be extreme. Is he doing something similar here? Is he making, because this is, I'm looking at you, Ashley, so I imagine I'm going to come to you with this question. It's because he is still making a point about how slavery, this is post-Civil War, post-slavery, but he's making a point that America can't move beyond the post-slavery. So he's still using this room full of awful characters to make a statement about America, or again, am I reading too much into it?
I think less so. To me, this, of all his films, seemed like it was more just for fun. I get the sense he's starting to sign off, he's building up to his...
I don't think he's signing off on 10, he's just talking.
I think he is, and he'll come back for a rebirth after maybe a decade. But no,
make musicals.
This was just for fun. He's whacking everything in there he's ever wanted to do. The violence gets even more ridiculous. Double shotgun to the face at one point. So I think he is just he's having fun here. It isn't as serious as Django. It isn't as politically charged as.
But then that sort
things.
Of, I don't know. But you can't have, you can't, well, you weren't the one defending the, earlier defending the violence towards Jennifer Jason Leigh's character, but we can't have it both ways. We can't have he's having fun, yet he's using the N-word, which we won't use on this show at this time in the morning, and in the way that he does. And he can't have these serious things if he then is.
That's how some people have fun.
I think he can. I think Tarantino can. I do. I just do. Because he's done it now for like four films or whatever, so clearly, and they're still giving money to make it, and people are still going to go and watch them, and people are still giving them great reviews, so quite clearly, he can.
Is it? We sort of underestimate the audience, the general multiplex audience a lot of times. Oh, you know, Transformers Age of Extinction makes £4,000 billion or something. But, and you know, aren't people stupid? But this is a three-hour film that is, and Tarantino's a very peculiar fish, really, in terms of how he directs and his scenes. The fact that, and did you all sit in cinema set were, that stayed still throughout this 3 hours of what he's just talking with occasional shotguns?
I had face to the side every possibly 10 minutes. Not, I didn't think I'm a squeamish person, but you just want, it's relentless. So after the fifth shotgun,
so that's
the
what's
face,
keeping audiences.
I've seen enough brains and I can't do it anymore.
Yeah, that puts me off. Simon?
I mean, I kept reading about the 3 hour running time, but it didn't feel like it while watching a film.
First half did.
The first half felt like 3 hours. The second of the 3 hour half only feels like 2 seconds.
No, I'm with Simon. It didn't feel 3 hours.
I mean, that's the thing, yeah. First half is an hour and a half, a normal length of a film, and then the second half just whizzes through. Yeah, so I didn't feel the length. I didn't notice anybody else in the cinema feeling the length. It was actually one of the rare times of being at the cinema where everyone else in the audience seems to be completely enraptured and not looking at the phones, not, you know, talking, being irritating. Everyone's just watching the film.
Well, that's amazing, really. I had people talking on the phone during Room yesterday. So yeah. Okay, all right. Well, we'll move on. The Hateful Eight opened last week and is playing at both Light and View cinemas in Cambridge, not at the Arts Picture House for copyright reasons, really. The View version has an intermission, as we've discussed, though it isn't the 70mm version, which is only available to see through the Odeon cinema chain. They have exclusivity to that print or those prints, and that's why Picture House hasn't got it, because Cineworld owns Picture House. Oh, it's just children playing a game. It is a Certificate 18. New release, The Danish Girl, is the highest profile of a number of recent films approaching transgender issues, stories rather, but where 52 Tuesday and Tangerine were small-scale art house releases, The Danish Girl, directed by Tom Hooper, plays its tale of groundbreaking sexuality as a plush and populist period piece. Based on David Overhoff's novel of gentle fact distortion, The Danish Girl stars Eddie Redmayne and Alicia Vikander as Einar and Gerda Vaner, an attractive couple basking in the bohemian lifestyle of 1920s Europe. Both paint. Einar favours moody landscapes, while Gerda is just beginning to make a name for herself with portraits. When a female model fails a show one afternoon, she mischievously asks her husband to don the stockings and socks shoes instead. But what begins as a game of dressing up and subterfuge wakes Einar's sense that whilst born a man, his real identity is as a woman.
I want to sketch you. Lily.
We should go out tonight. Give them something different.
Lily. You're exquisite.
Exactly what happened last night?
There was a moment when I wasn't me. There was a moment when I was just
Lily. But Lily doesn't exist. We were playing a game.
Something changed.
He's lost his way. He needs a friend.
Let me help. I think Lily's thoughts. I dream her dreams. She was always there.
I need my husband. I need to hold my husband.
Are you all right? The fact is, I believe that I'm a woman.
And I believe it too.
You'll see previous Tom Hooper films, King's Speech and Les Miserables, have demonstrated he has little interest in subtlety. It's grand gestures on the largest canvas he can afford. Does this trait help or hinder a story like The Danish Girl?
Well, The Danish Girl in general is a very well told story. It's very humane, and when it gets it right, it really gets it right. There are some absolutely beautiful scenes, and I think in terms of the humanitarian aspect about this transgender character, it does it very well. But, and I hate to say it, I do think Tom Hooper is what ruins the film slightly for me, and I think it's because he paints a very beautiful picture. It's very glossy, it's stunning to look at, but in doing that, I feel like it actually lost a little bit of the complexities and the essence of the main character's story, and I found that quite frustrating in places, because there are scenes that just... You could have taken them out of the King's Speech and just put them straight into The Danish Girl. But The King's Speech is a film with a very different tone to The Danish Girl. And I feel like when The Danish Girl was getting the story right, it was brilliant. And then I'd just be let down because there'd be something a bit corny or a bit too glossy that just slightly ruined it for me. So I feel like that approach to his filmmaking might have hindered the film.
Ashley, is it? It for me, at least, it felt like a film of lots of missed opportunities. It kept looking at interesting aspects of Aino becoming Lily, and realizing he was a woman, and the woman he became at the end, and the operations. There were lots of little things it kept looking at: the idea of the male gaze versus the female gaze, and the idea of the patriarchy and how it forms how females see themselves. I don't think it looked at any of those things other than sort of a glance askew and then moved on. Am I hoping it would do too much? It seems such an important story to launch a thousand think pieces off, perhaps, and that's not what cinema is.
I was disappointed they focused so much on Eddie Redmayne's Lily, when I thought the actual story, a bit like how in Carol it's not about the lesbian relationship, it's about their love for each other. And what I loved about it was the love Eddie's character had with his wife. That relationship was the story I wanted told, and they just touched on it very, very lightly. Nothing was explained, and I wanted to see more of that. That was the real amazing love story that I think we missed out.
It's also the spark of anything that's interesting in the way they've told this story, not in the real life story itself. It's based on a book that makes up a bundle of things based on a true story. So you're already, to use a phrase I used earlier, looking at a copy of a copy of a copy. But the marriage between Alicia Vikander and Eddie Redmayne's characters is so vital, feels so alive, mainly because of her performance, because of Alicia Vikander's performance, that when this moment comes and he realizes that he realizes he can no longer cope with the fact he's been sort of putting this off, that he is a woman, all of that's dropped. And it was never fraudulent. He was never fraudulent in the marriage in the way it's portrayed in the film. But the film doesn't look at that. It doesn't look at the question of his sexuality. He's heterosexual until the moment he doesn't need to be heterosexual any longer.
Very inauthentic to me. It was just a very clean, convenient light switch, and the two of them did an about-turn.
It's as if some scenes were cut out. Because this was the first not. This was the first time, certainly by the end of the film, a sort of gender reassignment operation had been happening in the public eye, and he was a character far more in the public eye than the film suggests. But all of that's ignored, and she becomes inconsistent from scene to scene. That character is just bewilderingly inconsistent.
And I miss the boys as well. The character of Hans, Ben Whishaw, pops up inexplicably now and again, and I get the feeling, were I to have read the book, that they would have meant a lot more to me, but
they're not in the book. Hans is not in the book. Might be in the book, but he's not in the real life situation.
They just pop up like Jack in the Boxes now and again to move the story along, and I love them both. I wish I'd saw more of them.
And Simon, you were much more taken by it. You found a sweetness here, and it's certainly approaching the subject matter from a very important humanistic view.
Yeah, I mean, occasionally I do wonder whether we've actually been watching the same film. I mean, I thought it was an absolutely wonderful film, where you appear to be wanting complexity and, you know, a more political statement on this. What I found this film, and especially Tom Hooper in his approach gave to it, is accessibility. It was simplified. It's not as in-depth as a lot of the other films you saw recently, including, was it The Skin I Live In, the Pedro Almodóvar one, which we have covered before on the show. But when we're talking about political situation, not as much political, but cultural, social, is the correct word, social issues such as this. A lot of the changes to attitudes is introduced by the young, and a lot of the younger listeners and younger people are a lot more accepting of transgenderism and transsexual issues. What this film does, especially with its, you know, the approach, the look, the water ceremony, it helps introduce it to probably the older audience who will be looking for the King's Speech and are looking for more of those benchmark films.
But I agree with you, and I think that's important. But what you're describing is a form of, to me, is a form of pre-chewed cinema. Not everything has to have the complexity of as the Pedro Almodóvar film you've just mentioned. Yeah. That's obviously is aiming at a different audience. But this is hamburger cinema to me. It's looking at an interesting subject, but I think it's the fact it does see that there are other things it can talk about, even briefly, just admit that it's looking at them, but it doesn't. It's like
I think it tells a story it wants to tell and deals with the issue in these two. You don't need to overload everything at once. You can take things piecemeal.
I don't feel like we're asking for it to be overloaded, though. And I don't think you have to simplify the story that much to fit an audience. I feel like, as we were saying before, the inconsistency becomes because there are holes in the story that I don't think it would have been too problematic to address them.
It might have been more interesting to address them, even briefly. Again, I'm not asking for it to become a dissertation on, or indeed a spokespiece for the transgender movement today.
Yeah, I didn't notice really any inconsistencies or these complaints that you keep bringing up.
He's in no way.
I think you are looking for things that aren't there. I mean, I didn't.
That is a problem, if I could be critical. Yeah.
So I think you are, trying to look at it, trying to say more. I mean, there were some issues, the way it was dealt with Lily's changes at first and awakening and acceptance of his emotions and the feelings, which appeared to be very badly handled at the start of the film. And it didn't really think, really, you're going down this route? But then it was those kind of issues where they did come back to, they do readdress and say, actually, no, this is what's happening. It's always been a lifelong thing. This is what it's doing.
But he never...
And it does go back and address a lot of those issues.
I just felt... I've described it on the social media, and probably over the top, because that's what I use social media for, as a sexist piece of work, because it doesn't seem to grasp, and I'm obviously no expert here, what a woman is. And he seems to have almost a pathological dislike of the characters. Goethe's a fascinating, fully dimensional character,
yes,
who's dismissed. Let's leave out the reality of it, because this film only has one foot in the reality of the situation. When Einar becomes Lily, he learns. It's only about tics. And clothing. It's a parody of woman. And in fact, he goes to see a stripper and copies her movements. Now, it's a beautiful scene in the Tom Hooper Instagram sense. It's a daft scene. Why is he doing that? I want to know why. Is he doing that just because it's a nice scene? And it looked nice to Tom Hooper's amateur eye.
Because it looks nice as he's exploring what it's like.
He's got the perfect specimen to explore. I mean, he's got a vital, well-written, beautifully performed, interesting character in his wife, who's presented this way in the first half of the film. Yeah. Then as soon as Arnold steps into the realm and says, I'm a woman, he's... The way it's written, again, I'm only talking about the way it's written, proceeds to have zero interest in women.
That's the problem.
He ends up working in a shop. Why doesn't it look into the fact that he's a brilliant artist and this did happen, but as soon as he becomes a woman, he stops painting? That's fine, but why does he... That's reality, that's an interesting avenue to explore. Why does he see Lily, a name he's given by an extraneous character, which again seems self-defeating... I wanted to be a woman all my life, but let's give the characters... I get my name from somebody else. He becomes a shop assistant. Or indeed, look at why Goethe, who doesn't have an artistic voice until she starts painting her husband as a woman. It keeps looking at these things and saying, yeah, but you're bored of that. It's not about wanting to be a woman at all, because the film doesn't grasp what that is. It's about pantomime. It's about he being a pantomime.
He even has a line in the film saying, I have time for all of that later. He knows he's got other options. He knows he wants to do other things.
I don't think that's...
He has a job in a shop where in the 1920s that was a role that other women really, you know, normally did.
But
he could then fit in, be accepted in by all the other women and treated other women,
but then,
which is what they do, and that's what he's looking for. He is taking baby steps in a new identity.
But then if that's the case, why is it that the tone of the film does make it quite pantomime-esque? I think what I found frustrating was that in my screening, there were people laughing at bits that really weren't funny, and that was because of the approach that Tom Hooper had and the way it was painted, and I think that's why I've got a bee in my bonnet about it, essentially, because
Redmayne's face is the bee in my bonnet.
He really overplays it, I think,
so
and,
much.
Because he's not given anything else to play. He only can only pantomime this role because, again, to me, because it's I don't know. I'm bewildered.
Toby hates it.
No, I went into this film because I thought Tom Hooper's, I don't know why he's disliked. Is it just because he has floppy hair? Is it just sort of a class thing?
Because he stole Finch's Oscar.
Is it because of that? I forgot he'd won an Oscar until this morning. I found this, I think this film's incompetent. I think this is dreadfully incompetent. It's directed like an episode of The Bill. It is dreadful.
Still going to get an Oscar, though.
No, it won't. It won't.
I don't think it's dreadful.
It won't.
It just has problems.
Oscar talk is
it bad. Has problems. That's fair. And it's greatly beloved. And as Simon says, if ditching my harsh pre-chewed aspect, if it gets that audience and the way the Pride did to at least start to recognise,
that was a good point, Simon.
Then it fulfils its role. But I'll never want to see it again. Anyway, okay, all right. I don't need a gateway drug for this. Okay, well, The Danish Girl opened at the beginning of the month and is still showing at all three Cambridge cinemas. It is a certificate 15.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105, just as the man said. It is community radio in your city. Film director David O. Russell is in a groove of making loudly stylish films about chasing the American dream. We've had The Fighter, American Hustle, Silver Linings Playbook, and now new release Joy, all of which focus their attention on blue-collar aspiration. Loosely based on a true story, Joy stars Jennifer Lawrence as Joy Manango, a single mother living a life crowded with past mistakes and obtrusive family. Her mother lives in the spare room, grandmother lives upstairs, her divorced father is downstairs in the basement, a room he shares with her ex-husband. This life of endless responsibility has dampened Joy's spark until one day she dreams up an idea that could revolutionise housework. This one brilliant notion, once it's raised enough capital, launches Joy into new worlds of mass production, international fraud and shiny daytime television.
As you grow up and come into the world that has all sorts of things in it, money, crime, betrayal. Seems like you're shaking us down.
You can pay more.
I can't, and I won't. You realize that the only thing you're gonna have is what you make. That never
shone on me. You are in a room, and there is a gun on the table. I want my life to be. The only other person in the room is an adversary in commerce. Only one of you can prevail. Do you pick up the gun, Joy?
I pick up the gun. Speak on my behalf about my business again.
Emma, David O. Russell with previous films, he has a knack, and he's written the script again here, he has a knack for finding unusual stories, and this didn't seem... The story of the lady who invented the Miracle Mop didn't seem an initially very promising idea for a film, but I think he's doing some interesting things here.
I think he has made a very solid film out of this. He does it, you know, from the very moment it opens with this kind of odd shot of the soap operas that Jennifer Lawrence's mother, brilliantly played by Virginia Madsen, actually, again, you know, talking about Tarantino and whatever and female roles. What a joy to have this film with Isabella Rossellini and Jennifer Lawrence and Virginia Madsen and Diane Ladd all in really cracking roles with real meat in them. But anyway, regardless of that, and so it starts off, she's unwell and she just watches soap operas all day, and that's all day long, and that's kind of how it's then filmed. So I really enjoyed it because unlike other of David O. Russell's films, there is this definite switch to being consciously a step away from reality, at least for the first half. And it's filmed in this really interesting way that's almost kind of dreamlike, with this sort of with this narration by Diane Ladd, who's playing Joy's grandmother, explaining, you know, how she sort of made beautiful things for the girl, and she goes on through. And it is obviously powered by Jennifer Lawrence's performance. There has been some talk probably that she's a little young maybe to play this role, but being David O. Russell's current muse, he's going to put it anyway. And she powers through it just by her sheer force of charisma. And
she's getting a lot of, I know that, aside from the tabloid gossip, it seems to be everybody's now tired of her, but this is a very good performance holding together a very
an odd film.
Disparate, it is
an film. Odd film.
Yeah, it wouldn't work without somebody of her.
And I think it's probably very, I know Oscar talk is banned, Toby, but I think it's probably very fair that it's not necessarily up for Best Picture or Best Director, but she is up for Best Actress, because it is a really strong performance. And I don't know whether or not people just feel that she gets everything offered to her first or whatever, but she's excellent in it.
And we're
she,
fickle.
She's
sexist.
She can do that. She can bridge that gap between, you know, the essential working class, you know, this working class mother who discovers the reason for the miracle mop by, you know, breaking a glass or whatever. And she sells it so well. I really enjoyed it. I didn't think I was going to, because it's had such mediocre reviews. Oh, so that's probably fair enough. But I really, really enjoyed it.
I've not enjoyed the last couple of David O. Russell films at all, actually. But I wasn't really overly that. Okay. In fact, we only almost had included it on the show because the reviews have been so middling. But I think what I do like about David O. Russell, and he does this in The Fighter, which is a film I think is underrated, and Three Kings, which is a near masterpiece.
I think this is his best film since The Fighter.
I think it's... Oh, yeah, well, that's not much competition there. He's got faux gangsters and faux mental health to deal with. I think he does interesting things. He does strange, unusual things that other directors wouldn't do. As Emma's pointed out, just the sheer number of characters. She's not saddled, Jennifer Lawrence's Joy character is not saddled with another romance. This film is so loosely based on real life that they another director probably would have done that. But they don't. They have the ex-husband become a good friend, and there's never any scenes you would expect. This passes the Bechdel test easily. There's almost no scenes where they talk about men, except that maybe Robert De Niro's rubbish, who remains rubbish. There's no redemption for any of these characters. The rubbish characters remain rubbish. It's great that way.
This is my least favourite David O. Russell film.
But despite everything I just said...
It's his love affair for J-Lo is now affecting his work, I'm afraid. She's fantastic. I love me a little J-Lo. She was not right for this. The age didn't help, but I don't think that was the only thing. I didn't believe her.
In that role?
In that role.
I did believe her. I believed her as the scrappy...
Scrappy, yes. I believed her at the beginning when Joy was a young, scrappy upstart. She didn't pull it off.
But then
on.
They don't really... But to be honest, it concentrates very much on the early part of it. Once, you know, it kind of takes you up to the QVC time where, you know... And that is maybe a little... Geez, I think it's done quite well, where Bradley Cooper pops up for his very kind of brief cameo almost. And, you know, again, he's been in, what, the last three David O. Russell films?
I don't understand the problem people have with directors using same actors.
I don't have the problem, no.
Sorry, it wasn't a dig at you,
no,
actually.
No, yeah, but it's kooky and I like it. It's one of the things I like about David O. Russell's last few films. It just did not work here. Bradley worked, she didn't work. She could have been something else or not in it at all. She just didn't work for me.
She carried the film for me. But there are many things to enjoy about this film, and it is definitely a little odd, a little skewed, a little unusual. But I
had fun.
It's not your standard biopic, that's for
sure. Bought a self-squeezing mop the week after. So.
Did you really?
Totally.
Crikey. I didn't
life
even
changing.
Know. Has technology not moved on mop-wise?
I don't get on with steam mops very well.
This is all news. I don't know anything about mops.
Dog owner, you need some scrub action.
Oh, okay. Sorry. we'll talk about this after.
Okay.
After the show, because I have a feeling it'll be dull for everybody else. I did like, just to wrap up, the sort of... As you mentioned, it starts with these soap operas that Joy's mother watches, that Virginia Madsen's character watches. This escapism of big shoulder pads and ridiculous denouncements. And then QVC takes that role.
Yeah.
When she goes to visit QVC, it's not the same actors and actresses playing those roles, but it's doing the same thing of offering people a release of a fantasy world that they can partake in, that they can interact with. It's one step on from soaps. And then the way the film can dance around the reality of the situation means that when Joy comes in and refuses to wear any of that because she's not comfortable, it's another move towards reality TV. And David O. Russell's savvy enough and interesting enough to be just, this is sort of what I didn't get from The Danish Girl in a way, is that he's raising these issues. He's not talking about them, but they're just bubbling away under the surface. At least to me, I might be wrong. He might turn around and say, no, nothing like that, Toby.
For and it to he be does interesting. It in a very competently visual way as well. So as a piece of cinema,
everybody always says he's sort of Scorsese light because he does needle drops but there's no huge character to it. But in this day and age where everything's so bland, this is mainstream multiplex drama, and as that, I think it really sings.
Yeah,
it doesn't stand up to the work of the great directors, but I think
I only went to go and see it on Sunday, so I've been out for a couple of weeks, and it's still packing a very mixed audience.
Yes, it was full when I saw it. Yeah.
And I think, as
it
like
is
you're saying,
very
as not,
accessible,
and as not perhaps pre-chewed hamburger
without being
film.
Without being it's accessible without yes. being sort of
without being spoon fit, without yeah, being
the upper end of accessible.
Upper end of accessible might be what I changed Bums on Seats title to.
Love.
Okay. All right. Well, Joy opened all the way back on January the 1st, but is still doing well enough, as we've just discussed, to be screening at all three Cambridge cinemas. It is a Certificate 15.
105 Sport. Join us every Saturday afternoon as we take a closer look at what's happening in the world of sport.
Follow all the weekend's local and national sporting action, plus a focus on the sporting activities in the community.
Join the 105 Sport team every Saturday from 2 to 5pm.
On community radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
You are listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. My name is Toby Miller, and I'm joined today by Emma Marchant, Yossi Osman, Ashley Capaldi, and Simon West. As always, there's a lot to come after we wrap up in, ridiculously, almost 15 minutes. This will be impossible. We're instantly followed by Mental Health Focus, a catch-up on some of the excellent reporting Cambridge 105's Matt Webb has been doing on the subject of mental health. Between 2 and 3 is 105 Sport, as you've just heard. Then at 5pm, and this is very interesting, at 5pm it's LGBTI discussion with Rainbow Radio, and they are looking also at The Danish Girl. So that's a review to listen to. It's far more informed. It will be far more informed than my wibbling ramblings, I assure you. Still to come here on Bums on Seats, we'll look at Leonardo DiCaprio suffering for his art in The Revenant. But before that, we've only got one possibility for escape.
Thank you for letting us do this interview. We're grateful to hear your story.
Thank you to everyone who sent their good thoughts and their prayers.
For 5 years, you made life in that small room, that prison, as nurturing and normal as you could.
You're
so old now.
You are so old now.
Yep. Hey, do you know what we're gonna do today?
What?
We are going to bake a birthday cake. You chose to tell Jack that room was the whole world, that there was nothing else.
Good morning, lamp. Good morning, plant. Good morning, sink.
I wanted him to feel safe and that it was a great place for him to live.
Did you ever think you would be free?
You're gonna love it.
What?
The world.
Directed by Lenny Abrahamson, from a script by Emma Donoghue, who's adapting her own award-winning novel, new release Room has risen from its low-budget roots to be a major awards contender. Room opens in one room. It is the room 24-year-old Joy has been held captive in for 7 years. A 12-feet by 12-feet space with sink, toilet, kitchen and a bed. Her only contact with the outside world is a skylight which gives a glimpse of the weather but offers no hope that her cries for help will be heard. Her only companion is Jack, her 5-year-old old son, born in captivity. For him, the shrunken world of Room seems perfectly natural, with anything outside nothing more than a bedtime story. Looking after Jack is the only thing giving the beaten Joy hope, and he may offer her only hope of escape. Simon, Room surprised me by being such a measured drama, usually with award winners, and this is up for Oscars here, there and everywhere. You expect some sort of heightened sort of histrionics, but this plays a very quiet game. Do you think that quietude sort of helps or hinders the film's dramatic purpose?
I think it probably helps it, because I think it gives it a more realistic approach to the subject matter than what you would expect. It is a amazing film to watch. It's the whole film told from the point of view of this five-year-old boy who's never seen the outside, and it's how he can relate to, you know, all the objects, all the people, all the world when he's had such a contained upbringing, and, you know, how it affects him later. All the award talk has been going on about Brie Larson, who is, you know, absolutely stunning in this role. I said no histrionics, you know, no shouting, underplayed, yet such a vulnerable fragility, yet resourcefulness, you know, in her character. A lot of the subject matter in this, you know, is quite, you know, quite scary, and can be incredibly upsetting, you know, to a lot of people. But because it's been filtered through the child's point of view, it kind of underplays it, which makes it, I think, a bit more watchable.
Does that help? Does that possibly hinder the drama at the end? It's a film of two halves, and we won't discuss the second half in much detail, partly because of time, partly because the film was only released yesterday. But because it's predominantly from Jack's view, it's not quite from always from his point of view, but because it's his voiceover driving the film's real drama is obviously in Joy's situation, the nightly rape, the harrowing circumstance, which we never see. So does that mean the film sort of doesn't sidestep, but it can never go properly into that?
It doesn't sidestep, it doesn't go into it, it doesn't dwell on it, but it leaves all of that to the, you know, the imagination of the audience and the empathy of the audience. So while you are being told things from, you know, the points of view, you know what's going on. It is scary, it is harrowing. It's an emotional roller coaster of a film. You know, I was close to tears on more than one occasion during this film. Yet it's very positive. You know, looking at the human spirit, it is a very positive, uplifting film.
But again,
as well,
I agree with you, but we've got to be careful, because all of that makes it sound like it's awful. It's either a difficult watch, or it's a Coldplay song in aspiration.
It
isn't.
It's not a difficult watch. It is a mesmerising watch. It is absolutely fantastic. The performance from Jacob Tremblay
as Jack
is absolutely stunning, and it's going to go down as one of the, you know, great child performances ever. It is, you know, up there as some of the Jodie Foster's earlier roles. It is absolutely, you know, amazing, the fact that he actually carries pretty much most of the entire film, you know, as him and Brie Larson, because for most of it, it is a two-hander as well.
And even when it expands,
it doesn't expand to a great deal.
Joan Allen's very good.
Joan Allen is amazing. Yeah. William H. Macy, briefly.
That's a good scene. We won't discuss it, but that's a really good scene.
I mean, I went into it knowing as little as possible when I went to go to see it. So I'm very, very, you know, I may sound very vague here, but I don't want to give too many spoilers out to other people. I found going in not knowing what was going to happen to be the best approach for this, because some of it is a mystery. You don't know how things are going to turn out. And it was a whole ride for it. That said, it is, again, keep using the term harrowing, you know, it is a very triggering situation, the subject matter. However, it is told lie to it. It's a lot more, again, using the word accessible. It doesn't necessarily feel as bad as it is, and you can understand why, because it's been sanitised through the eyes of the child. But it's definitely worthwhile hunting out and going to see.
Okay, well, the room opened yesterday. You don't really have to hunt it out, because it's screening at both Arts Picture House and the Light Multiplex. It is a Certificate 15. We end the show red in tooth and claw with The Revenant, director Alejandro G. and Inarritu's crazily ambitious tale of revenge in the early American wilderness. Set in the first few years of the 19th century, The Revenant opens with the decimation of a hunting party by Native Americans. Only a few escape. Domhnall Gleeson's commander, John Fitzgerald, a fur trader played by Tom Hardy, and Hugo Glass, Leonardo DiCaprio's expert guide. This pitiful party are further beleaguered when Glass is mauled by a mother bear, leaving him only just clinging to life. Too weak to continue, it's decided to leave him to die quietly with a watchful and paid Fitzgerald to dig a Christian grave once Glass has passed away. But Fitzgerald, eager for the reward but not the weight, simply buries Glass in a shallow grave and leaves him for dead.
My son. The proper thing to do would be to finish him off quick.
He's to be cared for as long as necessary. I understand.
Get away! Help!
What happened?
We did what we had to do.
He was buried right.
All I had was my boy. And he took him from me, you understand? He's afraid. He knows how far I came to find him.
Emma, The Revenant is, just like Inarritu's previous work, Birdman, which was only a year ago, fast director. It's a stunning technical achievement, but is it in the service of characters and story that engage?
I almost think the characters and the story, well, I mean, it's hard. Sorry, let's start again. Every year there is a film that comes with the story behind it. And obviously, there's been so much hype about The Revenant, about all the physical hardship that Leonardo went through, about, you know, this ridiculous story about it's going to be Leo's year for the Oscar, which you can't avoid. But when you go and watch it, that all just gets blown away. From the very first scene, like you said, where this Pawnee tribe surprise the fur trappers as they're kind of coming through this incredible forest. I mean, the cinematography and the direction is amazing. And from that first scene, from that first battle scene, which is unlike anything I've seen on the screen for a very, very long time, to the very, very final, fairly audacious shot, I was just... Inarritu has created a world and a piece of visual spectacle which will it's better than I've seen. And, you know, visually, it's one of the best films I've seen this decade, I would say. It is a mastering achievement. And it's backed up by... You may disagree, Toby, about Leonardo.
He's fine. He's just...
It's a difficult... You know, it is virtually a silent film. It's interesting to me that, you know, this and Mad Max, which have come up with all these plaudits, are almost like they are these kind of silent, sort of visceral films or whatever. And, of course, Tom Hardy's in both of them. Tom Hardy is brilliant.
And he can't shut up. He chatters constantly throughout the whole film.
He's excellent. He's just chuntering. He just chunters. But he fleshes out a character, which when you read it on paper, you kind of think, oh, he's just going to be a cartoon baddie and that's why we have to have our hero getting revenge. But he's more than that. The whole thing is more than that. But the towering achievement of this film is to put that on the screen and you come out thinking, I feel like I may have just spent 2.5 hours in 1820 South Dakota. I am freezing cold and I feel like I have a bear carcass on my shoulders. It's awesome.
Yossi, lean forwards, please.
Sorry.
Is it just an ordinary Western in catwalk clothes? Because that's what bothered me a little bit. There's not much going on, I found, outside of the grandiose cinematography. Again, I didn't want much plot, but it didn't seem to be hinting at much under the surface. Please tell me I'm wrong.
You're
wrong. It makes good radio.
I think you're wrong. I think there's so much to it. I mean, obviously, there is the visual elements, which are just... Oh, my God, I could go on about them for ages, but Emma's already done that fantastically, so I'm not going to. In terms of the story... I feel that there is a good story behind it. It's a revenge story, and... I'm going to judge it by how I was affected, by how Leonardo DiCaprio wants to go after Tom Hardy and that is the drive and you really are in there with him and you want him to get back. And I was blown away by it. And I think when you get towards the end and there's that build up to the denouement, it's just like it's really, really well done. And I it's not like any Western I've seen, certainly. I thought it was... very well told and very well made.
Simon?
We've talked so far on this show about how harrowing The Room is and how violent Hateful Eight is, but this film hasn't both beat. This film is brutal. It's not so much a warning as a recommendation as well, because it is a tremendous film. It's such an amazing piece of filmmaking. The camera work, the opening battle in a single shot, which is almost taken from Birdman, is just an astonishing scene. And it's got, you know, scenes of Terrence Malick, but he goes places Terrence Malick wouldn't even dare go. It is an amazing accomplishment, this film. Leonardo DiCaprio has got the Oscar sign up this time, even though we keep saying no Oscar talk. His, you know, I mean, the whole themes behind the film about, you know, death, battles, rebirth, again and again. It's worth about, you know, when life is worth fighting for. And, you know, you have a lot of hardships in life, but they're nothing compared to what he goes through in this. He's got to keep on fighting. It's such an amazing film.
Emma?
I was going to say, it's interesting you said Life Worth Fighting For, because one of the best lines in it is when Tom Hardy says something like, well, I wouldn't really call it life, I'm just living. Yes, and that is such a key part of this. You know, it is a rough old time, you know, for these fur trappers up there. So I think when you're asking for more story, it boils down to such simple stuff. These guys haven't, it's not,
I
like,
know, I'm not asking for more story. That I think my main problem is I found all the Native American stuff which was added, which isn't in the original story.
I don't think Tom Hardy's character is in the original story either.
Well, no, Fitzgerald is. Fitzgerald's in the original character. He stole Glass's rifle, and that was the story. I don't mind all that. I just found the additions, the Native American son, that I found all of that hokey.
But the only hokey.
Yeah, but then you see, that's the problem. It wanted to give it a heart. For all its grandiose cinematography, it's a very conservative, normal little story.
The only hokey,
which again is fine, but that means I find everything else pretension.
The only hokey part I found, because one of the interesting things I thought about this film is the fluidity of it and the smoothness of it, but also with these incredibly jarring scenes, and that bear mauling scene is like nothing you will have ever seen.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. It's brilliant. Amazing. But there were about three parts that did jar me a bit, and they were actually the dream sequences.
That's where.
And I hate to say it, but if there's one thing, but I was like, oh, it's almost Gladiator. It was almost a little bit Gladiator.
I think that's when the director's real intentions, his real interests, are sort of laid bare. Everything else is sort of. For me, is it looks fantastic, and maybe if I'd seen it in a slightly better mood, I would have come out in not the ferocious storm I was in.
Did it make you angry, Toby?
Everything makes me angry, Emma. I like Tom Hardy a great deal in this. I thought that was great, and no, it's fun. I just found, you know, again, it was a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing,
but
like all of this director's work.
I did feel because it comes very close to all. There are parts that are almost laughable. It's not giving anything away for everybody to know that Leonardo ate more bison liver and got thrown down, and it's sort of ripe for pastiche, but I think the commitment that these filmmakers had to it and the actors had to it carry you past that, so you really firmly believe in it.
Sorry,
Toby.
No, it's fine, you're allowed to like it, you know. I'm glad you have something that makes you happy, but it's the commitment. I think it's the commitment at the service of this hokey Native American stuff that I've just found tiresome. To me, it was as bad as Avatar in terms of the simplicity of it.
Toby, I would just
and the show's over.
The last thing as well was I was amazed at how busy my screening was last night. I know, maybe, you know, rare that I tend to go to the Cineworld in Haverhill, and it's rare that it is sold out on a Friday night, and that full big screen was sold out, and I think that's a really good sign that people are going to see such a visually spectacular and just committed piece of filmmaking. It's incredible.
I think that's fair. You don't need to gang up on me. But it is very good. I'm being unfair. Okay, well, all right. I don't know, we'll discuss it off air. I'm going to ask you a question again. We've just been through that. The Revenant opened yesterday. It's not so interesting we can go on about it twice. It opened yesterday, January the 15th, and is a certificate 15 and is playing at all three Cambridge cinemas. See it with someone you love. And that's all we have time for on the show today. We will be, podcast of the past hour will be available via the Cambridge 105 website shortly, and you may find links to our other shows, including our top 12 films of 2015, and you can track us down on all manner of dying social media sites such as Twitter and Facebook. We're back, all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, on Saturday, January the 30th, with a show that looks to be far too full of films. Some will have to go overboard. There'll be Youth, Paolo Sorrentino's follow-up to The Great Beauty, newsroom drama Spotlight, The Big Short, Michael Bay's 13, and much, much more. As it very sadly has become necessary, we'll play out with some David Bowie, in this case Sense of Doubt, which is from both Heroes and his score, The Christina F. Stay tuned for Matt Webb and Mental Health Focus, but from everybody on Bums on Seats, in the words of the great Dr. Lazarus, we're off to the pub.